I'm not trying to be better than someone else. What I'm trying to do is serve the music at its highest level. And the better I get, the more I realize what that is. And to try to come close to circling back to the divine perfection.
Okay, welcome back, or welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I am your host, Dr. Michael Gervais, by trade and training, a high performance psychologist. And today, I am really excited to sit down with Elizabeth Pitcairn. Elizabeth is a renowned classical violin virtuoso. And I don't say that lightly. After making her orchestra debut at age 14, she has gone on to travel the globe with her violin, performing as a soloist in various world-leading orchestras at some of the most prolific classical music venues on the planet. Elizabeth is also known for performing with one of the world's most legendary instruments, the Red Mendelssohn Stradivarius violin that was made in 1720. Said to have inspired the Academy Award-winning film, The Red Violin. I hope you've had the chance to watch that movie. If you haven't, you're in for a real treat. And I think we're in for a bigger treat to learn from a true master of craft with Elizabeth. So in addition to her acclaimed career, she's also passionate about advocating music education. She serves as the president and artistic director of the Luzerne Music Center in upstate New York, which provides world-class music instruction for gifted young musicians. Elizabeth, I am so excited to sit with you. Thank you so much for being with us today. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Like it's an honor to be on your program, and I am performing a concert right after we are finished. So it's all in a day's work. It's a perfect day for me.
Oh, that is awesome. Do you still get nervous?
I do, but I've learned to embrace my nerves as a good thing. Instead of resisting them, I allow the adrenaline feeling to course through my body to the point where I can feel it head to toe and feel the buzz and the sick feeling that comes with it and work it out of my system in advance of the, let's say, the show, the event. And the farther in advance that I start getting the nerves, the better I perform when I get to the show. The worst part is to have it happen as a rush that's unexpected and your body has trouble handling the rush of adrenaline. So even though it feels terrible, I mentally say to myself, bring it on, just let it go through.
Okay, so you welcome it. You know, it's part of getting ready. It's part of the dynamic of doing anything that matters. Whether that's, you know, wrestling down a bear or going on stage or having an intimate conversation. Sounds like you're metabolizing the value of it. And then more importantly, you mentioned it in two ways. You mentioned it, the adrenaline and then the sickness. Are you talking about the sick to stomach feeling, the nausea, that type of feeling that happens as well?
Yeah, a lot of people call it butterflies.
And you don't?
It doesn't feel like nice butterflies to me, but I can relate to the description of when your stomach feels a flutter. But I have never actually physically vomited before a show, but I have come close to it. And then I went into the most state of calm that I've ever been in my life moments later where I could do anything. I was so calm and so focused. And it came after the most extreme set of nerves that I had ever had.
Let's open that up. How did you do that? And let's call that a 10 out of 10. And let's call that a 10 out of 10 on a internal activation scale. Let's just mark that as a 10, because it sounds like you haven't had, you know, bigger than that. And then so let's unpack that a little bit. And then let's unpack what maybe a 3 out of 10 or a 6 out of 10, somewhere in that range feels like. And I just want to set the scene and the context. How many years have you been, I know it was age 3, But give me the number of decades that you've been deliberately, nauseatingly, to use that word again, deeply focused on refining your craft. How many decades?
So four, 48 now. I started playing when I was three.
I can't wait to get into like how you think about deep practice. There's only a handful of people on the planet that have the level of talent and mastery and skill that you have. So I do want to spend deep time on that. But let's stay at the surface really quickly about this nervousness, this anxiousness. Let's mark the one that you're talking about as a 10 on a 10. And then the moment, like what's leading to the quote unquote sick feeling? And then when you feel it, this is like a very mechanical question. What do you do with it to be able to move it?
Well, the feeling generally inspires a response. It's either procrastination or it's let's get going with this and put in some serious work. And the adrenaline will allow me to practice untold hours with incredible focus and then walk out on the stage and then elevate my game. I hang around Brian too much. My game to a whole new level, that my performance is dramatically better in the performance than the dress rehearsal. So I save something back in the dress rehearsal, but I channel the nerves into being able to play with a tremendous amount of energy and put everything I have into it and go into a place where I'm not even aware of being present anymore, just gone. So that's what, you want that help, because it can bring you out. If you're exhausted and you've been traveling, you're tired, if you're slightly sick, or if you just need energy, then it will give you like a turbo boost to do that.
Okay. So you see it, that it does facilitate higher performance abilities. It can also debilitate. And so, Okay. So step one that I'm learning is that you embrace that it is part of the equation, and you've chosen this lifestyle. You've chosen this way of living. You could play in your living room and like, that's one way of playing the violin, or you can say, no, I need to share it and move it. Whether it's building your nonprofit or sharing the love of music, there's a public nature to it. So you've designed your life to share. And then, so that's part one. And then part two is when you feel it, you say, this does help me. So one, it's part of it. Two, it helps me. And then when you feel it, this is what I want to understand. What do you do at that moment? Do you talk yourself through it, or do you breathe your way through it? Do you, do some exercise? Do you take a nap? Most people can't eat because their stomach is upside down in knots. Like, what do you do?
I accept it and welcome it. When I was younger, it would turn my legs and hands into jelly because I didn't have enough time spent preparing, and I didn't feel confident deep down. So my answer to all of that is to prepare to the point that I know I can walk out on stage and do it, even no matter how nervous I feel, because we can't lie to ourselves.
Oh yeah. Okay. Now we're getting into it. This fake it till you make it, it doesn't work. This kind of, self-talk that is uncredible doesn't work. And not having reps and time under belt of high activation, nervousness, nearly vomiting. If you don't get to that place, it doesn't work. You need to understand that place too. And what I love that you're saying, and it's so grounded, is that, so I work ad nauseum. I want to have mechanically high skill, high reps under my belt, so that when I say to myself, I can do this, you have a whole body of work to reference. You have real history under your belt to say, yeah, I actually can do this.
Yeah. You have, if you believe you can do it, you will do it.
Yeah. Right. Sounds so simple. I don't think that you work in kind of tropes or, like, I don't know. What are those things, phrases that people throw around all the time, like cliches? You don't work in cliches, do you?
Well, that's an interesting observation. I don't, and I'm not even good at them. And I accept that I'm not, someone like Dave, he's so good at current lingo, but what I know is what I know. And my search for how to be the best and to keep getting better.
Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time in early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours, reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading, but it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing. It just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out. listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well. So be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's Hims, HIMS.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. Hims.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer, hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. You said two things that I want to open up again is you want to be the best. You didn't say I want to be my best. You said I want to be the best. So can we unpack that just a bit more?
From what I understand, the difference between being good and being great is about 2%. So if you want to live in the rarefied atmosphere of the very best that you can be, then you're driving yourself at an infinitesimal level. And that to me is fascinating, to go there and live in that. And it is really hard work. You're always working and you have to be driven and not comfortable at, you know, I don't know if it's a personality thing, but just there's certain, I'm fine with being a okay tennis player and going out and hitting some balls. I give myself that leniency because that I want that to be fun. But when it comes to violin, I want to be able to play the violin with mastery, with the kind of precision and perfection and delivery of the music. And I'm frustrated when I can't deliver the music the way I want to deliver it. And that comes through studying more, understanding and connecting so many things to be able to achieve the result, which is a divine perfection of beautiful music that touches people's souls. And to do that, your technique and your mastery of the instrument and the craft connected to what you have to say musically has to be in sync.
I mean, for the last 30 seconds, all the hair on my body standing up, because it's not necessarily the word you just chose, which is the delivery, but it's where you're coming from. And you're using words that are actually jarring to me. So I want to understand them, like the divine perfection. What the hell is that? Okay. Pun intended. And then you're all, so, and, but before we go to that, which is so, that contrast is amazing to me, because perfection to me, I'll just qualify it, is like, I'm not interested in it. I'm not interested in perfection. I'm interested in artistic expression and getting right on the edges of what I know and don't know and being able to stitch it together, whatever it is in that moment. And for me, it's mostly based on relationship, words, feelings with other people, myself and others. And so there's something there that I'm more interested in, but you use divine perfection. And then, but before we get there, you also mentioned, and you mentioned it in two different ways, like trying to be my best and trying to be the best. And I'm saying this out loud to myself, come back to quotes. Okay. So what is it, my best or the best? Or how do you wrap your head around those two related but different approaches to growth?
When I'm thinking about my standards, I long ago put away, I think in my early 20s, I let go of the insecurities of feeling like I wasn't good enough, and started judging myself according to my own personal standards. Yes, hearing my colleagues and hearing how the best in the world did things, but then having my own standards. So I'm constantly raising the bar of my own standards, and I know there's no such thing as perfection or the best. In fact, there's one of my favorite expressions is from my USC teacher Robert Lipset that I studied with, and reason I moved to California was he said, we practice for perfection so our mistakes are not as bad. And that he talked about balance, and he talked about mastery in terms of having everything in balance. And he said to me, Elizabeth, you want your playing to be overall with an evenness. You want a certain kind of a presentation that doesn't, one thing isn't amazing and the other thing drops down and it's not as good. You need a certain type of a balance. I'm not trying to be better than someone else. What I'm trying to do is serve the music at its highest level. And the better I get, the more I realize what that is, and to try to come close to circling back to the divine perfection. Can I explain what divine is? And perfection is not there. We are not perfect as humans, so we can't be perfect on our own. And I don't know what happens when I go onto stage and I go into my zone, but something happens, and I often feel like I'm a conduit. And I know that what I'm doing with the music and bringing this beauty, peace, and all kinds of emotions is a powerful thing for people's souls, for mine and for the audience. And we go on a journey together. So it would be on my part to let them down, to not deliver that experience is not fair. And people feel when you're on, when you're really able to do that and make a phrase, a beautiful phrase that's an arc. And how do you do that with a violin in your hand and a bow in your hand? You're not a singer, but you want to recreate the experience as if you were singing.
It's beautiful. Your depth of understanding has led to this question for me. And I've never asked this question, which is, do you feel as though you're a conduit of the music, or are you part of the music? Are you the music?
I would say the former. I would say the music is flowing through me.
That's right. That's what I'm trying to sort out is you see it. So you're a conduit. So the music is somewhere and it's flowing through you and your instrument and then expressed, you know, through sound and vibrations. But so you don't see yourself as the music.
I suppose I could say that I become the music.
Yeah, it's a new thought for me. And it's new based on the way that you were just talking about how, one, there's a responsibility that you hold. There's a posture of serving the music, which, and the music was created by somebody, put this note here and that note here, and then hold the contour of those two, three, four, five notes in a row in a certain way. That's when you start talking about balance, I was thinking about like the contour of it, the shape of it, and I'm not using technical words, you know, but it's just the way it feels where it's not like, oh, what was that? And so if your quote unquote divine perfection, if your high level of mastery can allow me to get lost in the unfolding contour of the notes, then you've created an experience for me that is different than if I'm navigating when is the next sharp, you know, or like funky note gonna happen and bracing myself for it, if you will. Okay, this is good because you also, there's in your approach, so you started at age 3. Hold on. I got to watch you play. I want to make sure everyone knows that is that it was an intimate hall. It was full capacities, maybe 200 people. It was quote unquote designed for the most optimal sound experience that one can have. It's at the Brain and Creativity Institute at USC. And it's like, it's incredible the way that it just sounded. And for me to be able to watch you play in that moment, I brought my son and, you know, and my wife was there and we're able to just like be lost in your music. So I'm saying this with like a personal experience under belt that is, that was a special moment. All that being said is that there's a responsibility that I feel. There's an intensity, a fire, there's a servicenessness that you have, and it's a really unique tension between the two. So let me take a quick pass. At age 3, you're introduced to music and you started practicing it. You probably had some appreciation, but there was a lot of parenting involved. I'm making up a narrative here. And then there was a pivotal moment, I think, probably in your life. And that was when you were gifted the red violin. And so can you talk about the responsibility that you feel and how some of the earlier experiences and then when you're gifted the red violin, how that shaped your, not only your personality, but the way that you've set up the rest of your life?
Well, absolutely. There was a quality of why me? But there was also a quality of understanding that this was going to happen to me. I think I knew that this was going to happen to me from a young age for some reason. And I don't have a way to explain why or how, except that I was born into a musical family. And even when I was in the womb, my mother was teaching and playing her cello. She went to the Juilliard School and I think it started with that. I mean, on her due date, she was teaching her lessons. And yeah, so I had that sort of as a role model growing up, that kind of ethic. And my father was very musical and had perfect pitch that he inherited from his mother, who was Dutch. And so I didn't know I had perfect pitch until I was 10 years old. And I didn't know that not everyone had perfect pitch. I didn't even know that for me, hearing a pitch and saying what it is the same as us seeing the color red and saying it's red. I mean, an A is an A. So when 10 years old, when people discovered this and freaked out, I was surprised. At age 8, my mother had a cassette recording that she played in the car. We lived in the country, so we drove, it seemed like hours everywhere to get anywhere. And so she was playing this violin concerto over and over. I was a great violinist from Odessa. And I was eight, and I would lay in the back seat in the car. It seemed like hours on end. And I listened over and over to this violinist playing, and clear as day, I could see that it was me standing there on that stage playing that piece. And I asked her when I would be able to learn it, and she said, when you're 14. Well, I was eight, you know, but it's the hardest violin concerto written. It's by Sibelius from Finland. And I didn't end up learning it until I was in my early 20s. And finally, when I stood on the stage and heard the orchestra, the live orchestra, just playing that, and I was actually playing, that was quite a moment. But those things were so real to me. And I think that my mom always planted something in my head. Maybe she said, oh, you'll have a great violin, or you'll have, she knew how much a great instrument is instrumental to a young person's development and to their concept of sound. They're really, I mean, just imagine a race car driver trying to navigate a race course and they never get a decent car to drive. How are they supposed to learn what it does? Or someone, or an Olympic horseback rider, and they don't have a great jumper to go over the fences. And so that's kind of what that violin was. And it wasn't a gift. It wasn't a present. It wasn't, that kind of runs around the media as a narrator, a narrative. I don't know where it started, but it was nothing of the sort. It was a tool. It was a working tool to have the best equipment possible at a very critical time where instrument prices were skyrocketing out of sight in the late 80s, early 90s. They were just going up, and this was breaking. And you know, and my mother was right. In today's dollars, you know, it would be completely out of sight, unaffordable. So that is why, you know, a 16, almost 17-year-old girl got that violin at the time that she did, because of those factors. And it was the timing of the red violin coming up for auction in 1990 at Christie's of London, that hadn't been on the market in 45 years. You're lucky if you see one of those in your lifetime. You're not going to see it again. They don't come and go. Something of that magnitude in the top 10% of the instruments that Stradivari ever made is not going to surface repeatedly. It's going to get bought, and it's going to be held for a long time. So there's only a couple of owners that we've ever known about. And I'm just lucky that, you know, and you talked about responsibility. Talk about a responsibility to look after it and take care of it. But a greater responsibility is what you do with it. And I think serving my purpose and serving people and helping people and my passion for youth and education has channeled all that gift into a real purpose here on this in my lifetime.
Who are the previous owners?
It was Lily von Mendelssohn, who was the daughter. So all of the Mendelssohns are descended from the great philosopher Moses Mendelssohn, but her father was Franz von Mendelssohn. This is in the early 1900s in Berlin, and he was a noted art collector. They were a banking family. They had a quartet of Stradivarius, which in today's would be valued at well over $150 million. If you could even get one, there's only 10 dealers. So. And then before her was Joseph Joachim, who was a Hungarian soloist, composer, great violinist, who's one of my all-time heroes. And so I was stunned to learn that he had had it. And that was part of the trail of discovery, trying to figure out where this instrument was. We still don't know between, let's say, 1880 and 1720. There's absolutely no record, but the condition of it is remarkable. So someone took really good care of it. And then one more after Lily, it came from Germany to New York City in 1956, where it was in a private collection of an amateur business industrialist violinist who never played it in public, and actually traded in his own Strad and additional monies to purchase the Red Mendelssohn.
Okay, I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here, Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to do is I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside. But when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise and, you know, chains slapping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming, full stop, they are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's hydro.com, HYDROW.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydro.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double-clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption. They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you will check them out. Bring me into that moment. You're loving violin at this point. You're loving playing. Like it's a thing for you. This isn't like casually mom's wanting you to play more often and fighting you to like get your 10 minutes a day in. It's not like that, right?
Yes and no. I'm sure if my mom at that point had said, you know, when you're that age, you're exploring life. And I was always so, you know, kind of lonely growing up in the country and with not many people around. And I had a driver's license and I had friends at school
Wait. You just can't drop that in. I was really lonely as a kid. keep going. Now you're painting a different picture for me right now, which I love this contour. Okay. So let's set the stage a little bit more is that I don't know your family dynamic from an economic financial standpoint, but I know your family's family, like, you know, you guys have a massive industrial business. And so the shorthand is like, you guys were doing pretty well, you know, but I don't know the dynamics there. And then, you know, picking up the violin at age 3 is a little intense. Right. And then, so this is why I'm trying to understand the family dynamic a little bit. And then you add lonely to it because this is going to set the stage of like how you practice, why you practice, and pivotal moments that you either ignored or captured, you know, the ones that got away and the ones that you just reeled in really nicely. So what do you mean lonely?
Well, at a certain point, I can remember and I can tell you all the things that happened. But I don't have an emotional charge behind it anymore. So I have the memories, but I don't, but I'm a completely different player of late because I went through that process to come back to violin with love and the knowledge of how to play it, but none of the anxiety and the tension and the insecurity that I felt when I was younger. So we were lonely. I grew up on 80 acres in the country. We didn't even have a center of town. We have a township. There's no, and then my friends and I had to practice almost 4 hours every day. And often practicing was kind of used as a weapon, if I wanted to go see my friends, I had to practice. And if I wouldn't cooperate, I couldn't go until I was done practicing. And, to the point that there was never a day off. But you know, people ask, was it child abuse? No, it wasn't. It was just, I had a driven mother, and everything she did was because she saw this dream of me being this soloist, and she knew I had what it took. And I also believed it. And she always, deep down, I had that belief that she instilled in me from a young age that I could be all of that. And I was, you know, of course, in your mother's eyes, you're the best. But she made me believe it. And
how did she do that?
She believed it. And so I believed it. So she would say things to me like, you have an extraordinary gift, Elizabeth. And she'd say that you're the way she would say, oh, the way you play Bach. She would just say, that's extraordinary. And your gifts, and she would just talk to me about how good I was. But then the flip side was that performance didn't go well. The criticism was staggering. I would look out to see her face when I was done, and then I would just hear about what I had done wrong. And fair enough, because I was never really prepared. I was always trying to get out of practicing, and I just wasn't accepting that was my path. I was just, if I could read the power of now and go back and be a kid, but it's what I do now. So here we are now. What I accept that the sacrifice is all the practicing, but it's what I overwhelmingly love to do. And so I don't fight it. But as a child, I kind of knew that she would make sure I got it done. So I didn't take any responsibility for myself. Hence, at that point, had she said, okay, it's up to you now, and you can do it or not, but if you don't do it, we're going to sell the instrument and there'll be no more lessons. I think that by the age of 14, I for sure would have taken it on, and it didn't happen. I can't go back and redo it. But
okay, so there were definitely pressure in the system, right? There was high stress to practice. There was disappointment when the performance was, or critique, and it's verbal, nonverbal as well. It sounds like when the performance was below standard or just bad. And you did have like an appreciation. You had a bit of a vision. You had a talent for it, but it is really, I'm glad we're talking about this, because it's really rare for a six-year-old to be grinding, you know, to do the 4 hours a day type of work. So let's talk about practice. What is the psychology or the mindset that you hope people hold as they're going through the four phases of practice? So it could be something, I'll give you a couple of different ones, right? Like, well, let's call it a mindset of perfection. Like even during warmups, like this has to be perfect. Or it's like, no, I'm cruising, I'm going, and like I'm putting in the work. And, you know, actually part of practice is making a mistake and figuring out how quickly I can let go of it. And like, how do you hope that they hold their mind or mindset during practice?
That question right there is everything. If when we actually execute what I'm going to say, this is my understanding of what to do. It is a true hold. So I'll put myself in the place and time of the event I'm preparing for. And sometimes I'll have a flashback when I'm on stage, and I'll have a flashback to the moment 2 weeks ago at 11 a.m. when I was tackling that particular issue in the piece that I needed to solve. And I'll have a premonition at that moment at 11 a.m. in that moment. And I'll think, the work that you're doing right now on this passage is going to translate into your performance 2 weeks from now. And this is the moment where you're accomplishing that. And that's because I'm so, I can picture myself in the concert hall in real time and playing for people. So it's real. And I'm 100% focused on the work in that moment.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is that you use your imagination to tune your focus so you can stay locked in, and you see yourself or the environment that you might be in later to increase the activation. And so it's a little bit like this, you're using your mind to create a stimulus that isn't naturally in the practice environment so that you can stay locked in and focused. And when you do that, it sharpens your ability to perform and practice. So I think awesome. And the discipline to do that is noted. Can you, let me ask you a handful of questions. When you use your imagination, do you see yourself in your own body or do you see yourself watching from a different perspective?
I put myself physically there, like on the stage of Carnegie Hall. I'm there in my practicing. So I put myself there on the stage. The people are there. Everything's there. I'm on stage and I'm delivering in that moment and I'm analyzing how does it sound at that moment.
Are you in your own body or are you watching yourself from somebody who happened to have a seat on stage?
Oh, I would say I'm in my own body because in my mind, I see my hands. I see what I'm doing. I'm looking at what I'm doing. I'm right there.
Mm-hmm. And then do you see it in color?
Yeah.
And do you play this movie in real time or do you slow it down?
I think real time because it just heightens my listening and my and analytical and critical thinking abilities in the moment to decide if I just played something that no one would ever hear, or if I'm delivering it at that moment with the perfection that I need to play it with, and it makes it real for okay. me to, yeah.
Yep. So what you're doing is you're not closing your eyes. Let's just be really concrete. You're not closing your eyes in a non-practice environment and seeing yourself perform later. That's not what we're talking about. Maybe you do that, but right now what we're talking about is you're in your practice chair, you're holding your violin, you've got your instrument, and then you're using your imagination for a moment to set the context of the environment of a high-pressured, a performative environment. And then that probably kicks up your heart rate just a little bit. It dials in your focus to lock in. And you are looking down using your eyes, either in your imagination or concretely looking at your instrument. But it's like the background is not the practice background. The background, using your imagination, is the performative environment. So you're amplifying the activation internally by creating through your imagination. It's like rubber bullets. No one's actually there. And then, so just one more double click. You said, I analyze. Are you coaching? Are you critiquing? Are you curiously observing? What is that quote unquote analyzing? What's the contour of that analyzing?
Well, I'm listening. Basically, if I just, let's say I recorded it and I laid down the track and then I listened to the playback and I'm like, well, is this good enough to go out on a CD right now? There can't be any scratches. There can't be any, little imperfection in the sound of the bow going across the string. Basically, did I like what I hear? I had a similar experience when I was about 21, I won a competition to solo with the Philadelphia Orchestra. It was a big deal to come home. And it was the moment of truth for me because I got to play with the Philadelphia Orchestra as a result of winning the competition. And it's the Philadelphia Orchestra, my hometown, and they're, my opinion, the greatest orchestra. And they, they play their opening interlude and then I come in. And it was a Mozart concerto. And I come in, and then my first three notes are alone of the piece. I hear my sound, and then I heard the orchestra, and then they enter very softly. And now I hear my sound rising above the orchestra. And it was a total out of body experience. I wasn't, I just stood back, way back, like in the hall, like a person in the hall listening. And also I felt my grandfather, who's no longer alive too, because that's where he always went and listened to the orchestra. And I heard my sound rising above the Philadelphia Orchestra. And at that moment I said, okay, do you like what you hear? This is it. This is everything. You've worked your whole life for this. What do you think? Do you like it? And it was the best I had ever played. I couldn't believe it. I thought, this is, I've done it. I'm here.
I would not, I got chills. I would not recommend that you're evaluating while you're doing it, but it does happen, right? That it does happen. But you used a question. Do you like what you're hearing? Is that what you, the question you said? Do you like what you're hearing? And then because that, okay, so let me tell you why, like I'm being a little cheeky because this is how it happens. And most people, if they open themselves up for the question, like, do you like how it feels? It is a, it's like the hard drive is running a different program and it kind of slows everything down. So you have less available internal resources to adjust to the unfolding next moment. And so in that moment, it's dangerous, right? And, but when it happens, and you answer it, yeah, this is great. There's an on-ramp into like a little bit more space. But if you answer it like, no, I don't know. Will they like it? It doesn't matter what I like. And now there's this whole other narrative going on, which is like, oh God, right? Like the, okay, we got problems here. So it sounds like you were in, you said out of body, because it sounds like you were entering into a flow state, and I'm using that word technically, where there's an action and awareness are unfolding together. And it's just a kind of a oneness with what you're doing. And then you were able to manage your grandfather's perspective, your perspective, ask a question, answer the question, all while being able to have your fingers be on automatic and, you know, hitting the notes on point. And so, all right. Okay, that's fun. Sorry for the long kind of narrative there, but that's really cool that the way you described it. And there's two things in here. You said this was the moment. So it sounds like your philosophy is that there are big moments in life, as opposed to a philosophy which is like, it doesn't matter if it's this orchestra or that orchestra or this small room or this large room, it's another moment to share my art. So it's another moment, another opportunity, as opposed to it's a big moment. And so I want to make sure I hear that correctly.
Yeah, it was a defining moment for me.
Finding Mastery is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something. It's actually providing a state change for you to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be a bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course. That's fun. And it's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they've found is fascinating. Across various real-world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep, 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability, and up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community, you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code Finding Mastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, Apollo, Apollo, neuro.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to AquaTrue.com. You spell it AquaTrue.com and enter the code FINDINGMASTERY at checkout. Again, that's AquaTrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there. You're conjuring up, because of that feeling, you're conjuring up for me the gratitude I have for the person that put us together to be able to learn from you. And so Brian Wertesheim, and he's my financial advisor. And so we're talking about podcasts, we're talking about things we're interested in. And I said, you know, I haven't had the chance to have a true master of an instrument on. And he says, oh, really? And so he says, well, what about Elizabeth? And I said, oh my God, Elizabeth? And he says, and so I got really excited that I got to meet you and, you know, listen to you play, which was from another mutual friend, David Belasco, that we both know. He introduced me at USC to your work. Would you be okay if I called Brian right now? Because I'm super grateful and just feeling kind of flooded about it. And he's told, in preparation for this interview, he told me when he walked through like your life, and because you guys know each other really well, it was like amazing things that that he added perspective with. And so I don't know, would it be okay if I give him a jingle? Would you be cool with that?
I would love that. Let's talk to Brian.
Let's see if we can do this. Okay. Can you hear the phone?
Michael.
Hey, Brian, I've got a little surprise for you. Can I put you on air? Can I put you I'm on the podcast with Elizabeth Pitcairn. And so
love surprises.
You do love surprises. Okay. I do. Elizabeth, do you love surprises?
Absolutely.
You do. Okay, good. All right. So one, we're talking about thank you for the introduction. And then the second bit is like, can you explain in your understanding of Elizabeth, and as you guys have been long-term friends?
Well, yeah, you know, I'd love to. You know, when I think back over the years that we've had this great friendship, which probably is more than 10 years, maybe 12 years, I still remember the very first time I met her at her home. And she was doing a private recital for about, I don't know, 15 people. So that in itself was exciting, just to be in that room. But, you know, then, you know, I remember listening to Elizabeth for about 45 minutes, and it was such an emotional experience that it literally brought me to tears. And I think in the world we're living in, there's so much that distracts us. To be able to sit there in the peace and quiet of her beautiful home was like a life-changing experience for me. And that really laid the foundation for what became a great friendship. So when I think about Elizabeth, I think about her just in so many dimensions. So a lot of people, you know, don't know that, you know, she's truly dedicated her life to this instrument. And, you know, not only that, but she, you know, she has a camp I don't know where this woman finds all the time to do all these great things, but it's really awesome. And there's just something about her where I think she understands, you know, what a gift she's been given.
Oh, Brian, you put a huge smile on my face. Just hearing it makes me think of all the things we've done over the last 12 years.
Very cool. So listen, relationships are what it's at. Your relationship with your instrument is fascinating to me, and your relationship with the unfolding experience. And I've only have just a handful of questions here left, just two or three questions. Okay. One is, when you make a mistake, what do you do with that? How do you frame the mistake? And then technically, what do you do if you're performing?
We talked about practicing and what you do when you practice. The next step is practice performance. So I have my piano accompaniment. I mean, if I'm going to go solo with an orchestra, you only get two rehearsals, and you get them when you show up, and it's the day of the concert, maybe the day before. So you have your rehearsal pianist and you drill as much as possible. So back in college, for example, we would play every week in the studio master class and just drill it and drill and drill it until it was ready for public. And that gives you a sense of all of that. So you are practicing for that ultimate perfection. Then when a mistake happens, you want to make your mistake go away before, as it's happening, you're correcting it. And sometimes you correct it before anyone else can hear it, and they don't even know. But otherwise, if you have, you know, I trained to be able to avoid catastrophic mistakes, mostly from my own nerves, because I would get so nervous that I would create some kind of, calamity. But I taught myself how to keep going no matter what. So I don't stop no matter what. And I can always get back on. So that was, you know, sort of step one to getting that. And then I think it's that type of performance practicing and putting yourself in that, visualizing that you're actually in the performance, so that you have ultimate command. And then studying the piece from all different angles, from all the, you know, four types of memory. From I use my visual, my aural, my analytical, and my kinetic senses of memory to lock in. Should something go wrong on stage, I've had a moment where I blacked out, my mind went blank, and I didn't know what came next, and my hand physically jerked to the right place. The muscles, and it was rather violent because they took over and it went there, and then I kept on going. So you can't just have your muscle. You need all of it. You need to be able to see the music in your head, in your mind as you're playing. Those are all safety nets.
Elizabeth, you're a legend. I wish that more people, you know, I wish we were doing this live so that I could, one, hear you and feel your music, but also so more people could be exposed to it. And so hopefully there's a time that you'll be back in California and I'll get the chance to hear and feel, you know, your music again. But I would want to encourage folks to check out your music. Where can they find you? What's the best place to go besides your camp? You know, like that's one obviously large tent pole that you've placed in the ground, but where are some other places people can go?
Oh, I have a website. It's called redviolin.com.
Of course it is.
I had some good friends who were savvy at business and encouraged me to get that website years ago.
Awesome. Elizabeth, thank you for the treat. Thank you for bringing me into how you work with your mind and, you know, being able to share the story of how the Red Violin has helped shape your trajectory in life, and also, you know, how you practice to be one of the greats of all time. And I just want to say thank you. And I really appreciate the contribution you're making to our community as well.
Well, thank you. And all the things we talked about today, actually, I'll be thinking about more to put into words how it's possible. But I do want to thank you for asking the questions that you asked that allow me to talk about a really special and private part of my life, and just in such a manner that I really enjoyed this afternoon, this day with you.
I feel that, and thank you. I'm honored that you said that as well. And so I hope you're primed and you're going to go create a special moment for people that they're going to talk about, like Brian talked about, for, you know, 10 years from now, saying that it was moving and it changed me. And God, what a cool way to go through life. Are you happy? Because you are, like, sometimes masters are not happy. Are you happy?
I am happy. I found a way to be happy after not being happy for most of my life. And you know, that was a shrug. It's not that I was never happy, but I didn't have a sense of peace and acceptance. I think I was resisting that what goes into it. There's a difference. There were just a few events in the past couple of years, from the death of my father and the pandemic, that shook up my world. And I had a chance to do some real studying and reading and learning, and to embrace that life is now. And no one makes you feel anything. You take responsibility for your feelings. And the idea of realizing that sometimes we can be addicted to stress hormones, that they can spike uncontrollably, and that negativity can also be an addiction in the mind, and to be able to find a place to drop those, and to and also not to worry too much about the future, or to detach a bit from the outcome. Let life unfold more naturally, and kind of realize that, you know, there's no certainty, but to accept that. And for me, I was always a driver, and I had to have things done. And it's been, I'm more effective actually slightly detaching and letting things be, and I'm just a happier person. So to sum it up, I think that when we find our own place of kind of joy in within us, and that we're good with ourselves, then that's truly a good place. And one of Eckhart Tolle's quotes resonated with me. He said, "Don't seek happiness, because seeking is the antithesis of happiness. But freedom from unhappiness is attainable now."
Awesome. It's rich. And your commitment to growth, and now in this phase of being happy and meaning to be in the unfolding present moment, and having a contentment with that unfolding nature, is really powerful. And so thank you, Elizabeth. Wishing you absolutely the best.
Thank you, Mike.
All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential, so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, Information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.